had such a sense of power.
Why don't you have wings to fly with, like the swallows so proud and free? All the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, dona, dona. Never knowing the reason why, but whoever treasures freedom, like the swallow has learned to fly. All the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, 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 dona.
We start, if there's anyone, we've heard a few people have had trouble hearing us. If you're having trouble hearing us, if you just wave your hand or something, we'll try and talk louder, or else just move around till you get in a position where it's easier to hear. Because sometimes I know my voice will sometimes carry and it sometimes doesn't. And sometimes we get so intense in what we're saying we forget to project or whatever.
Okay, we're going to, this session is a little bit different than it was announced. It's going to be in two parts. And the first one is just some stories from consciousness research that we find very exciting, because the scientists are now coming around and realizing that the metaphor of the body of Christ actually is real, and they're proving it in many, many very exciting ways. The second part of the session is called, because so many people have asked us about activating the whole brain, and we didn't do that last night. That the second part will, James is going to start with a piece of the activation of the whole brain. But it all fits together anyway, so.
Which may have the title of, was given to me by a French Catholic priest I happened to hear, who had struggled in a group that dealt with the body of Christ issues. And as he looked at his translations and his reflections, came up with the thought that maybe we've used the wrong, I think it's preposition, when, you know, we've said the resurrection of the body. He looked at it as resurrection in the body, of really looking at how to use that gift of the brain and the way we are. And really, by changing that, you really begin to change the whole thing, how to access that part, that experience.
Okay. We're going to start with, how many of you have heard the story of the 100th monkey? Okay, we'll start with that one because it's so much fun. And I also have a few copies of it, you know, as told by Ken Keyes, Jr., or Ken Keyes, whichever way.
Keys.
It's written like Keyes. It's pronounced Kais. There are some monkeys. There's a Japanese monkey called Muskaka Fuskata. And they've been studying them for over 30 years in the Japanese islands. And the anthropologists would drop sweet potatoes from airplanes onto these islands, and the sweet potatoes would get real gritty and dirty. And so one day in 1952, a young monkey named Imo, a female, took her sweet potato and went to the seashore and washed it. And she ate it and she liked it better that way. And this was really interesting. So she taught all of her siblings to wash their sweet potato. And they taught all of the other young monkeys on the island, this particular first island, where this advancement, this this cultural innovation, this quantitative leap in consciousness happened. They began to teach all the other young monkeys. The only adults that learned to wash their sweet potato learned it from the young. And then it spread all over the island, but it spread slowly, one by one by one. And it took about 5 or 6 years, but in 1958, one day, it was amazing. It was as though the 100th monkey on the island learned to wash his sweet potato. And from morning to night, all of the monkeys on the island were washing their sweet potato. That's a nice part of the story, but there's even a better part. Very soon, the other islands began to do the same thing. It jumped from, and you know the definition of island, right? Surrounded by water, no connection. And the information leaped across the land masses to the other monkeys. There's another very related story from...
Yeah, this is a more of a scientific story, and some of you, I'm sure, are aware of it. But a scientist in... I'm forgetting now whether it was
New York, London.
New York or London, began to work with rats to teach them to run a particularly complicated maze, a maze that was set up in such a way that it was not one that was normally done. And they set up a comparable experiment in the other city, whether that was London or New York. But they didn't teach the rats in that city to run the maze. They just had the maze there and they had the rats there. But as soon as the rats in the city of the original origin, whether that was New York or London, learned to run that maze, immediately the rats in the other city learned to run the maze without any instruction. The consciousness just leaped entirely across. And they found that that kind of learning is probably quite prevalent or quite common when you look at any of the great experiments. For example, the discovery of the basic molecule DNA was worked on by a number of different scientific teams, Watson being one in London, I forget the names of the others, in several places in the world, simultaneously, without contact, with sharing. They all discovered that molecule within like a week of each other, after years and years and years of research, and without connection.
Okay. I'd like to tell you another story that a friend of ours participated in. She's a woman who spent 15 years as a research subject, because she's one of the probably the best known psychics in the world. And she looks just like us. You wouldn't be able to pick her out, you know. She used to be a hairdresser, and about 17 or 18 years ago, from one day to the next, all of a sudden she was, you know, she could read the future, and she could tell what was wrong with someone's body and things like that. Just one other note about her: she's an extremely respectful person and does not invade anyone's space unless she's asked. So it's not something that she always does. You know, she's not always turned on. It's a space that she gets into, and she can do these things. Anyway.
One of the stories in that, because I have a part of me that's very skeptical, and I've been around this stuff for so many years now that there's a large piece of me that, I'm not sure of it. And Carol Ann came to stay at our house while she was doing a thing for blind awareness, and I was really pretty distant. I was just kind of waiting to see, you know. I saw that she looked pretty much like a hairdresser and so on, but I still wasn't convinced. Until one morning, I have a tremendous addiction for Cuban coffee, and my awareness is that most people in this day and age that are into a lot of these things, you know, found coffee and a lot of other things to be really bad. So I was going to be on my polite best, and I offered a cup of herbal tea, and she said, "No, I'd really like some Cuban coffee." That sold me.
Even the small things that sell one. What sold me was when she looked at my handwriting and she says, "My goodness," she says, you have a curvature of the spine on the fourth lumbar." She showed me how she knew it from handwriting, you know, because she takes people's handwriting as a means of having a connection to them. We're connected to everything. And our handwriting is brain writing. The brain writes And James and I do a little bit of this. If anybody's interested, we can show you in your own handwriting, you know, where, like, if you've got something wrong with your leg or you know, it'll show up because the brain will actually put it into the handwriting. It'll tell how you feel and the sorts of things. We're not experts on it, so don't expect a whole lot. But Carol showed me on that, and she says that she basically takes handwriting and holds it without her glasses. She can't see a thing, and most of the time she's not using her glasses. She just holds it. People think she's reading handwriting, and she's actually just reading energy. You know, and can say a lot of things that are quite accurate. Anyway, she was a part of this experiment. One day, she was asked to come and lie down on a cot and just relax for about, and she waited about 20 minutes. She made her grocery list up in her head and so on. She was waiting for the experiment to start. Before they left her, though, they had put on her finger I don't know what you would call that, but a little connector to a thing called a plethysmograph. And a plethysmograph, don't ask me anything more about it, because all I know is that what it measures is blood volume. It measures any change in blood volume. She's saying yes. You must know. The plethysmograph, okay. Well, so she had this plethysmograph on her. And also before she left, she was asked, the researchers left, they asked that she write on 5 cards the names of 5 people for whom there was an emotional charge, positive or negative, didn't matter, just some sort of charge for her. So she wrote the names of 5 people, and she waited for the experiment to begin. What she didn't know was that in another room, they had taken 5 names out of a phone book, 5 names of a person who was, quote, the sender, and then 5 blank cards, and they had 20 cards all stacked up. And at certain times within those 20 minutes that, you know, it was gauged, you know how these scientific experiments are, there's a time and a chart and so on. And as the sender was sitting with the cards, and every time she lifted one, the time was noted, and also the reaction on the chart was noted. Every time the sender picked up one of the cards that had a name on it, Carol Ann reacted. The blood volume changed, you know, and they did this for several years with different people. They thought, at first they were only using psychics, because they thought only psychics could do this, and then they started digging people off the street, you know, and they found that everybody does it. Whenever someone thinks about us, basically, is what some of the results are. Whenever someone thinks about us, positively or negatively, we react.
A little more explanation. They took 20 cards and her name.
Her 5?
Her name was on 5 of them?
She had just 5, yeah.
And how many did she react to?
All of them.
In other words, there was 5 cards with your friend.
No, she reacted to, actually, and I must correct myself, she reacted to all 20 cards. Every time a card was lifted, even if it was blank, and she was sent a message, she still reacted.
But the 5 cards didn't have her name. Her friends.
Like
names.
Her husband, her son, you know.
So it was more the fact that someone was thinking about it.
Exactly.
Right.
There was a more intense reaction if it was that
emotionally charged.
It was interesting, yes. There apparently was a bigger reaction. Also, if the name was negatively charged, there was a different reaction from the positive ones. Now, the scientists won't say this because they you know, they're so linear. It's got to be so obvious. But apparently, the positive ones they would go down on the graph, and the negative ones would either go up on the graph or something, you know, something like that, or reverse. There would be a difference, but they would not say it. You know, because they couldn't get it down to that objective scientific, you know. But there's obvious change that you and I would say, gosh, look at that. You know, but they wouldn't take it. They wouldn't say that the negative charge went this way and the positive charge went this way. So we don't know about that. But you want to talk about the yogic culture? And then,
no, I'm still back. Go ahead with the yogic culture. I'll come back to what I was thinking.
What do you want to say? What did you say?
When you're talking about positive and negative charge, there's a number of people where they've trained themselves to be in touch with that for their own selves. That you can literally get a signal from yourself as to whether you're reacting positively or negatively to a particular question or a particular dilemma.
No.
Some people will... That could be a signal. You know, just automatically ask yourself a question, and it could be a positive signal, or another side could be a very negative. Magali has several that are very typical
for her.
You're
going to tell on me, James. You're going to tell on me.
Well, one is your finger goes one way if it's yes, and your hand goes another way if it's no. And it's very, very spontaneous.
I guess I'm going to have to tell this story for a minute.
Jim does the same thing. He'll get a lot of signals. I'll get more of a feeling of just a radiation. If it's a positive thing, I'll feel it just, and sometimes it chokes me so I can't talk. I get stopped. And when it's a real negative thing, I'll find myself just getting real tense, and because I'm in the fight or flight kind of thing, I'm a fight person.
I'm a flight.
And it'll tense up. But the other is just a real, just a almost like a wave. And that's important. I better pay attention to that. So there's a lot of different ways, but you start to read your own self. Now that's the piece that I don't think the scientists are willing to say yes or no on yet. But I think
but
may before long.
Check yourself. If you've ever been talking to someone and all of a sudden you get this cold or this like goosebumps reaction, you know, to a certain something, and it's a very significant something, that may be a truth signal for you. And I tend to get it before the person says anything, so I'm like alert to what they're going to say, if it's really important, okay? I mean, it doesn't happen all the time or anything like that. But everyone has these things, you know? You get signals all the time, but we don't know how to read them. And James was talking about one that it develops different ways. One day, I called Carol Ann one day, and I was telling her about something that was happening on the top of my head. One day I was walking by a bookstore, and the top of my head just went like, as though it was a geyser, I guess. It just went, you know, and I was talking to I call it my higher self, to God, to my angel, to whatever, you know. I talk inside myself sometimes to God, really, you know. But I call it my signal, you know. But it's God, it's, you know, I hope. When she answers, I'll know. But anyway, I say, you want me to go in the bookstore? I don't have any money. I don't want to go in the bookstore. You know. So anyway, I went in the bookstore, and I walked around, and the signal died down. So I said, I didn't want to come in here anyway. This was all your idea. You know, starting to walk off. Right. Yeah. You know, I didn't have any money. I told you that. So anyway, I was starting to walk off, and all of a sudden, wham! This thing goes off again. And I look next to me, and I'm standing next to a book, to a book rack of these little journals, you know, that have they're just blank paper inside. And I had seen one the day before, and I'd said to myself, I'm going to get one of those. Because the woman that I was had met, this friend of ours from Miami, she was doing dream work, and she was, putting it into this journal. So I said to myself, this is what you're talking about. This is what you want? I said, all right. So I picked up a red one. Signal died down. I said, you don't like this color. I picked up a blue one. It was a little stronger, but still wasn't at the you know, because on the scale of 1 to 10, it was still like on 2 or 3. I said, you know, you still don't like this one. So I picked up a purple one, and it went. It went off. I said, all right, already. This is $2.98. I think I can handle it. I went over to the counter, and then it did it again. The one in the front here, on the third eye section, went off, and it was a book, you know, which was also like $3. So I could deal with it. It was just about $6 worth of stuff. But books are usually so much more. Anyway, that's how I began to. So I told Carol about this, and I said, you know, this is what's happening to me. What's going on? And she says, your body is starting to act like a pendulum. Apparently, when we realize that this stuff happens, that we are continually getting signals from the brain and from God, you know, from the universe, when it becomes possible, the stuff begins. We begin to notice it. You know, we just simply begin to notice our own instrument, this human instrument that we were given. And so I said, oh, that's interesting. It didn't dawn on me what she meant, a pendulum. You know what a pendulum is? It moves back and forth like that. That same day, I'll never forget, it was April the 13th. I was standing up and I was asking myself a question, and I don't remember the question, but it was a yes or no answer that I needed. Should I do thus and such? And my body began to sway back and forth like this. And I'm going, oh my. So, you know, I began to check that, you know. And it does that, and it comes in different ways. If I'm lying down, the other day it just started. I was asking myself a question, and the hand just went like that. And I said, So I checked it out, you know, I checked it out with questions that I knew were either yes or no, and the hand responded correctly. And you're not doing it yourself. I mean, you don't think you're doing it yourself, but there is a part of you, you know, a part of whatever that obviously does that, but you're not, it's not our conscious part. And I have to say one more thing about consciousness, and then I'd like to switch back to James here. Our consciousness, we're told, is like an enormous vault. Just, I mean, like a cavernous vault that's completely dark, except for a little 25-cent flashlight that we have with a tiny, tiny battery. You know the kind that you get in the store? And you turn that on, and that little bit of light, that little bit that you can see, that's what they say our conscious minds are aware of. The rest of the vault is a mystery. And yet most of us think that what we see and what we know is all there is.
What is the consciousness?
Pardon me?
We think what is in our consciousness is all there is.
We think that what we're aware of consciously is all there is.
In fact, in James' book, he goes into the fact that we really can't, we don't know what consciousness is. But the closest thing is that maybe for any individual, consciousness is what you pay attention to. It's like that flashlight. But it's a real delusion if you think that that's what it is. I mean, oh, if that's what the world is or what the phenomena are around us. And it begins, for me at least, to have some theological implications that, it really is true that God's awareness of what's happening is much broader than how I try to reduce her to my frameworks at times.
Carol Ann, by the way, Carol Ann Liaros is a Christian minister. So that doesn't come from like another culture or anything like that. She's a very common kind of a person, just like us.
So I'd like to share one other thing, and then maybe you want to talk about the yogurt thing, and then we can shift into the other. Yeah. But, and I don't know, we haven't talked about this, so she may be angry at me for this. But last summer, Magali went on a 3-week workshop out east, and I got very, very upset and disturbed the longer she was out there. And at first I thought it was just some kind of old remnants of chauvinism or whatever males are supposed to do, but I couldn't dismiss it at that. I was just really upset. And she was working with some really good people, supposedly, and I still think they are, in a setting around some stuff. And I was just really upset
He would yell at me every night on the telephone.
We'd talk every night, and it was just tremendous. And I was a tremendous fear I was experiencing.
Yeah.
And finally, the boys and I went up on the North Shore, which is Lake Superior, which is a spiritual center for me. Gone there many times in my life. And one night, when this was kind of at the height, thank God, very good health all of my life and very energetic. But I began to feel what felt like a tremendous band across my chest and like a heart attack. And finally got up and went down to the shore. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and as I'm sitting there, this vision comes. And I began to write it down in a poetic way, because those are the times of poetry show up. And as I got this poem finally finished, about 5 in the morning, the tension left in the chest, and I could begin to breathe. And the poem basically had to do with ships and rocky shoals and how things break up and that sort of symbolism. Do you want to tell the other side of the story?
Yeah.
What was going on?
Right. Well, there were a couple of things that were going on. One of them was that apparently I was supposed to be there to learn, because it was a workshop on the human energy system, activating the possible human, or what do we call it, human capacities, it was called. And it was a good workshop, but they were engaging in some things that would not have been good for me, and were not particularly good for some of the people in the group. You know, they were dealing in areas that they weren't particularly safe at the time, anyway. And what happened was that because I talked to him every single night, And he was like angry with me or upset about something, you know, and I was having to deal with that. I stayed grounded. I was very much grounded to the earth. And what he acted like a lightning rod for me. And so I didn't get into any of the negative pitfalls that some of the rest of the group did. I stayed grounded. He didn't realize what he was doing. I was angry with him sometimes, you know, for being so difficult. You know, why was it so difficult that I should go off for something, for a learning experience, you know? But we found out later that he was picking up that there was danger. And he was doing the only thing he knew how to do at that point, which was to act like a lightning rod for me. And so, anyway, the night this happened, we had had a conversation, and again, it wasn't a very pleasant one. And that night, just before the conversation, I had had a Kirlian photograph taken of my fingers. And it was a strong photograph, you know, it had a strong energy field and all of that. But the next morning, after he finished with the poetry, I went back and had another photograph taken because I wanted to test out our relationship, my relationship to Renee and all of that. The energy field was twice as large. So what he had cleared in his energy system had affected me. And the man who was taking the pictures, Douglas Dean, who is a biochemist and a Kirlian photographer and all that, he's one of the leading Kirlian photographers in the world, he says, McGowan, he says, what did you do last night? And I said, this was my answer, I said, I had a fight with my husband. But I didn't know until I came back what had happened. You know, that apparently if we do something to clear our own energy, those we love are also affected. That's the body of Christ, isn't it?
Yeah, or one can deal with the fear that another, because what was happening, the peace that was happening was one of the people who was a very strong, powerful person was literally hypnotizing people without their permission. And he was using that for his own control power structures. And that was what I picked up that was scaring me. And Magali, because she was kind of surrounded by the forest, didn't see that until later. Then all of a sudden people started coming to her saying, you know, something very almost demonic is starting to happen here and so on.
But I had been protected from it.
When you talk about clearing the energy, does that mean you express what's going on in you and then that frees it up to go to Magali? Is that what you mean? Clearing it.
Well, yeah, letting go, I think, is probably the best. I was feeling like I had the power to hang on to or to protect or what I could say verbally or what I could figure out with my left brain. Mm-hmm. I finally, because my body said, you know, stop that. Don't do that. And then I had to go into the other side. And then I could let go. And I could let go of that tension. I quit trying to figure it all out. And as soon as I did then I didn't know how I was still connected, but I knew that it was somehow much more powerful than when I was trying to figure all this out and give all of my nice logical arguments as to what was going on, why this was bad, or why this
why
wasn't
I should come home.
Or why she should come home. I'm not sure I even wanted her home. I was having a great time, you know, with some of the other things, but I was real scared. And I kept trying to give all these very rational, logical arguments as to what was, you know, was going on. And once I let go of that, then it was like that connectedness could be there again.
It might make sense to talk about positive and negative energy for a minute. You know that our bodies don't stop with our skins, don't you? I mean, the physicist, we got one sitting here, it scared me half to death when he told me after the session last night that he was a physicist. but we are continually emitting energy. We are continually putting out a kind of energy. And now this is going to be very interesting because we haven't said this to you yet. But from what I understand, pardon me.
Would you name that energy?
Name the energy?
Are you talking about ours? Are you talking about the ethereal body? Or are you talking about
Well, different names. You know, we call them. I'm going to simply use the term energy field. Okay. You know, for the moment, some people don't like the word aura. You know, and so ethereal body also sounds real strange, but energy field, yeah.
It's not electromagnetic, is it?
Well,
is it?
Let's go back to him.
The answer is we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah.
There's probably some element of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now this one is going to be. This is going to be very interesting, like I say, because he's sitting here, and I don't know if we're going to be talking about the same sort of thing. But anyway, what I understand is that there's a way to measure positive and negative energy, and that. And that negative energy looks real thick and long and coarse. And positive energy looks real soft and short and wavy. And in the linear world, if these two were going to get into a fight, which one do you think would win? This one, right? Wouldn't it look like this one would win? In reality, apparently, the soft, short, wavy stuff has the power to convert the long, thick, coarse stuff into shorter, softer, wavier stuff.
So it breaks
it up. It has very high energy. Now let's go back for a moment again. Now isn't that a beautiful affirmation of love your enemy? It's apparently the most powerful thing we can do, is to actually love those who are sending us negative energy. Now, In the Eastern tradition, there are colors that are associated with higher and lower energy, and they tend to go like the rainbow. What are the colors you think would be associated with negative energy?
Red.
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 Red. Anger. That's, well, probably because of what they call Kundalini energy, which is also rooted in that energy center, the lowest energy center, the root chakra. But that's when it's converted already.
So a red energy can be. It doesn't have to be the.
It's usually pink, though. It'll. I don't know. It depends. Depends, okay. But it is also creativity, right? But negative energy is associated with the lower spectrum colors. In the higher energy, is the violets and the purples up at the top. The physicists also will say that the higher spectrum colors, like violets and purples and stuff, are very high energy. And the lower spectrum colors, like reds and oranges, are, you know, are lower energy. You know, if you're familiar with the Eastern tradition with the energy centers, the root of the spine, which is right in the back, is the red energy center. And then you have the yellow. And the yellow, and then we have the orange, and then the yellow, which is the power center. You know, and then it goes to green, which is the heart, begins to get higher. These are considered the higher centers. Then it goes to blue, which is the value center in the throat. Then it goes to, what is this one? This one is, I guess, violet, you know, which is the third eye. And then it's purple, which is the crown, and it's the connection to God. Okay, is that interesting or is that interesting? Now that's old tradition. Think of the liturgy, think of the vestments. Which are the high colors? Pardon? The purple is used so much. What, the color of the kings? Royal, yeah. The color of Pentecost.
That's red.
That's red.
Well, that would be probably risen energy.
Well, there's another, you know, there's probably another piece around that I found very useful in for myself and in working with other people, and that's that if you look at usually there are seven primary energy centers, and you look at some of the findings over the last 10, 15 years now of the coming together of knowledge that's come out of the Eastern tradition and knowledge that's come from the Western. And your body can literally be a barometer as to what's happening or what issues one is dealing with and what needs attention. Like the energy centers of the genital and anal or that base region are the centers in Eastern thought that have had to do with identity. And then you look at some of the greats like Freud and so on that dealt a lot with identity, and that was about all he talked about. Or the scriptures, you know, the passage of the identity from one king to the other in the Old Testament. It's in the English, it's cleaned up, it's put your hand on my thigh, but actually it's put your hand on my genitals as the symbol of that passage. So you're dealing with an identity question oftentimes with this area of the body, or with a power question with this area, or with relationship and grieving questions or value questions, or synchronicity questions, or intuitive knowledge, or high knowledge. And by knowing where pain hits and what the body is saying, I think the worst question any of us learned to ask was why, because that tends to get us lost into trying to figure things out. I think much more profound questions of what am I feeling, and where am I feeling that, and what do I want to do with that, because, you know, how to let go.
I'm kind of a novice in here, kind of heavy, and I could think of,
when Love Your Neighbor, now all I could think of was the Jedi's.
The Jedi's.
Darth Vader and
yeah.
Luke. And
the man who wrote that knows this stuff, okay?
Okay.
I mean, there's no question.
I guess where I'm at on some of this, too, though, is how do you, maybe it's on your agenda, but if it isn't, I need help. How do you get in touch with your feelings? And I need some help there, because busy world and family, work.
That's his specialty.
Okay. Wherever that fits in, I trust you.
Are we ready to shift?
All right, let's shift into.
Wait a minute.
One quick question about the negative and positive aspects. You put to the point where you were saying it's possible for you to consciously convert from one energy to the other.
Oh, yeah.
And how do you do that?
Well, energy is energy, and we never lose it. It just gets transformed, and we can consciously, in fact, a lot of what we're going to talk about is shifting our attention. Let me show you something about attention, because the
can I say
something? Sure.
It seems to, again, this is not exactly something new, like you did say,
right.
Eastern tradition. I think it's all throughout the scriptures too. Like,
yes, it is.
That's right.
And we just have a different name for it.
Yes.
Right.
And sometimes come to twist it around it, thinking it's mental, like
right.
Prayer. Or
right.
Understanding who the Holy Spirit is and what he does.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The just really quickly, the Russians started some of these types of experiments many years ago, and they found that if they put plants into two different rooms, and they put one set of plants, and they give them the same water, same soil, everything, they put one set of plants in a room where nobody went and nobody looked at them, and they put another set in a room where they were constantly looked at, look at what happened. This was continually, and they did it with petri dishes, and they found that the dishes that were looked at with the agar, that something would begin to grow in the agar of the dishes that were looked at. We have a lot of power in our eyes. And if we shift our attention, if we, for example, if we put community over here, inclusive community over here, and we put racism or sexism over here, guess what we're going to get? Reality, they say, is what we pay attention to, because there is so much of it. We can actually choose what to pay attention to. If we only pay attention to the negative, we energize it. If we could learn to shift our attention, and that's what we're going to talk about, resurrection in the body, activating the whole brain to love.
I liked what you said up there, because I think that's really what we're dealing with, is very, very old stuff. It's not new, it's not... The basic for activating the whole brain, or to getting in touch with the right side, Carol would know a great deal about it, because it has to do basically with relaxation, of relaxing, or meditating, or whatever word you want. That's really the first step in any of it. And what I tend in my counseling practice to use homework assignments between sessions, feeling that people have much more curative powers for themselves than anything. I just happen to be there as kind of a catalyst and a set of cheap ears and so on. And one of the things that is just a must for me in dealing with myself or with anyone, if you're going to use even begin to use the whole brain, is to begin to be able to access that other side, that right hemisphere. And the easiest way I know of, and now it doesn't work for everyone, like you're saying, in the hustle bustle of life, but if it doesn't work, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And what it amounts to is to find a time when you can ensure for yourself initially, like 20 minutes, where you're not going to be interrupted. You know, if somebody can run interference for you, take the phone off the hook, answer the phone for you, keep kids out, whatever you need for that 20 minutes out of the day, which isn't a great deal of time. And then get comfortable, and to either lie down or to sit down. And what I do is I'll put my hands just over my stomach, and what you're going to do is diaphragmatic breathing. Like you're going to pull air in and blow a balloon up at the center of the body, and let off by pushing the air back out. Now, you could use any of the natural body rhythms. You could use heart rate or pulse rate or whatever you want. It just happens that breathing is the easiest to focus on. And once you've established that pattern of breathing, then you go back to your normal rate of breathing, but with that pattern. I forgot to tell somebody that once, and they came back and said, that was the most god-awful thing anybody ever asked me to do. I kept blacking out. My throat went dry. Don't hyperventilate. But just what I do is just lean my hands over my stomach. You'll feel that imperceptible rise and fall. And keep as much of your attention on the air coming in, going back out, coming in, going back out as you can. Now that's, for most people initially, much harder to do than it sounds. Because what happens is all kinds of thoughts will go through your mind. Gee, I shouldn't be taking this time. I've got all of this to do. I've got that to do, and so on. So what I do is I invite people to treat your thoughts like you're standing on a curb watching cars go by. You wouldn't try and stop the cars. Why would you get in them and go with them? You'd merely say, well, there goes a new one, and an old one, and a bent one, and a green one. And to treat your thoughts the same way. Don't try and stop thinking, because the harder you try to stop thinking, the more you're going to think. But don't go with any of them. If an interesting thought comes by, you can pick it up in 20 minutes. Okay, what happens next, and usually not the first few times that one tries it. Well, the other piece is that I'm very careful to say, some people, 20 minutes is an eternity. And so, you know, if you last the first few times for 3 minutes, that you're able to just let the thoughts go by. Great. It'll expand. Don't worry about how long you can stay, because the more you pay attention to time, the more you're going to defeat that. And the more you just say, well, I'll know when it's time for me to get up initially. But if you can get up to like 20 minutes. Okay, what happens next varies from person to person. Some people will say, well, all of a sudden I fell asleep. Well, how long did you sleep? Well, about 20 minutes. And so for some, it's like the experience of falling asleep. It's like that area of sleep where you're kind of aware of something. It's not real like deep sleep. Other people will say, all of a sudden it was like my mind went blank and my body was about four times as heavy as normal. I thought I was going to sink through the chair. And others will describe the same reaction, but the opposite. I was suddenly aware I wasn't thinking of anything, and it was like I was almost the sensation of floating. And others will describe, like, I wasn't thinking of anything, but I was watching this neat movie go on inside my head. All kinds of pretty images and pictures and so on. Okay, what's happening is if you put an EEG machine on any of us, it would pick up four distinct kinds of electrical activity or brain waves. And the uppermost one is the one we're over-programmed to, the beta wave, which is energy output wave. It's literally trying to figure the world out here and solve problems, and it's a very important function, but it's very noisy, and it literally drains. Well, in workshops I've done, I've been able to go up to 250-pound men who I was real aware were thinking, really had it figured out, lift them up by putting my hands under their armpits and just even lift them right off the floor. And then by centering them this way, you can go up to a 90-pound child and you can't budge him. You just absolutely read it. It literally changes the density of the body by pulling that energy back down. And that's the experience of seeing this movie or feeling the floating is the alpha wave gets engaged and it re-centers that energy. Pulls it back down. Once that's there, one is able then to much more engage, the whole brain. You know, I'm thinking of all different kinds of ways. The mystic Christians of the monasteries use that kind of form a great deal. In the present time, Indian people going on vision quests up on the hill are engaging that. Much of it is the ritual, the prayers, the relaxation, the being in touch with the Tinkishula. They're engaging that part. Well, then, you know, it opens up to all kinds of pictures and visions and prayers and so on. Once one is in that relaxed space, you can do some things with it through visualization. If you've gotten into that relaxed space, a very simple form, there are many forms of visualization. What I'm sharing with you, it shouldn't be thought of as limiting or a roadmap or anything. It's just kind of a seed, and let it grow where it fits for you. But one vision is to, once you're in that, just let yourself picture the most pleasant space, geographic space. It might be here at Holden when you're back. It might be someplace that's been real significant or important to you. Get a mental picture, either a visual picture or a feeling picture of what that place is like. And once that is formed, then find yourself the most comfortable place in that space that you can find. And picture yourself in that place, within that space. And just see yourself being just very, comfort is one of the things. I think God built us in such a way that we need comfort in order to access our whole selves. If we don't have that, no matter how much we're pushing the river, nothing's going to happen, except we're going to get drowned.
You're not talking about affluence, you're talking about just being able to relax physically.
And then the third part of the imagery, and this is the visualization that they're working with a lot in some of the research centers, and they're doing the power of imagination workshops and so on, is to let yourself in some open-ended way formulate a picture, a feeling or visual picture of what it is that your concern is at that moment, what it is you need to deal with. It might be a relationship problem, it might be a work-related problem, it might be just a burnout problem, it might be whatever you're dealing with that you struggle with. Cancer. Only this time, it's going to turn out exactly as you want it to. You let that picture form that it's emerging just exactly as you want it to. And if you have trouble staying with that channel, because everything is connected. There's one fellow that at the University of Marquette that says, and I've found this, and I never dared share it before he said it, you know, we all need our authorities to rely on. But he said, you shift channels and you let it be as negative as you possibly can make it. Like the clown, you over-exaggerate it. And even when dealing with suicidal people, and this is what he was talking about, and I tried this before and I thought, I'm never going to tell anybody that because I'll lose my... so on. But he said, what happens is if you over-exaggerate that, it eventually you can't stay with it and it flips back. And then you can change channels back again to the positive and let it turn out the way it is. So sometimes if one is totally blocked and you can't get that, just change channels when you're in that relaxed space. And stay with that until you've really experienced what it's like to have that thing work out. And then because the part of the brain you're working with at that time is the right hemisphere, which is a spatially oriented side of the brain, you need to give it something to work with. You need to give it some kind of spatial image. And I'll share the one I use, and I guess I shared it with some people, and I say it doesn't fit for them. But the one is I see myself going up this high mountain, and I've gotten intrigued with these mountains. The mountain is so high, the cloud is sitting on it, you can't see the top. And you visualize yourself going up that and breaking through that cloud into this complete openness in space and this... where everything is free and there's that sense of freedom and sense of openness and so on. And just experience that kind of open spatial sort of thing. You've given the right hemisphere something to work with. And then when you're ready, slowly bring yourself back up to whatever you want to be about for the rest of the day. But you've given that side something to work with for that time.
I'd like to just say that the journal method I'm going to teach on Thursday and Friday uses this very particular thing that's been going on here. We won't be able to do a lot of it because it really takes a weekend to begin to touch this, but I will indicate to you how to go into the alpha state, and then you do your journaling out of alpha rather than out of
beta. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
I'll be there. I'd like to say something about Rupert Sheldrake. There's a man named Sheldrake from England who has come up with an incredibly controversial but also very exciting kind of a theory, and he calls it morphogenic fields. I don't know if you've run across it yet, but it's very interesting. And what it basically says that there's this what they call morphic resonance, that if any one of us here is a meditator, or you know, if there are any people anywhere in the world who have ever learned to meditate, and there are large groups of people who are especially now learning how to do it because they're realizing this is the way the brain reprograms itself, this is the way it activates. It's one of the greatest change agents, if not the greatest change agent that we have. If that is true, they have set up he calls a morphic resonance, that in a sense, in a spiritual sense, has opened a path that will make it easier for anyone who hasn't done it before to learn to do it because others have already done it. So if you learn something new and you know it's better, qualitatively better, than what the rest of your group is doing, just simply do it and understand that 100th monkey phenomenon, this morphic resonance is possible, and that you will, in a sense, help people to move in that direction by blazing a path. There's an experiment that's going on right now out of Brain Mind Bulletin where they've got three different poems in Japanese. One of them is a poem that was just made up. One of them is an old nursery rhyme that millions of Japanese children have learned. Every Japanese knows this particular nursery rhyme. And then there's one that's just simply a jumble of Japanese words. And the test is, how long does it take you to memorize each of those poems? They're very short. But the one that is the easiest is probably the one that those millions of Japanese have already learned. And this is the way they're testing it now internationally. They're testing this particular theory. It's very, a very simple process. But so that if one in one's mind has this picture of a relationship that is different, that somehow the ending changes on something, you know, that you are setting up in your head a morphogenic field, an amorphic resonance, you know, so that the relationship could go in that direction easier because you set it up in your mind first. So.
Okay, I'd like to say two things real fast, and then would you do the kinesiology?
Sure.
And the prayer, pause to negative. Because that may be where we'll have time to get to. The other two, what? With this relaxation, what I was describing is what McLean calls the paths of empathy. That literally, when you get into that kind of journaling, meditative state, or relaxation state, it starts with the neocortex and it affects every part of the triune brain. And it normalizes the whole system and lets go of the stress. And he calls that the paths of empathy. That it's more than, like somebody's already suggested, it's more than just thinking. It's really literally letting oneself get in tune. Sometimes some people will have difficulty staying focused on their breathing. And again, don't push the river if you find that to be happening. What they're finding is there are some real good assists. And from music, if you put music on very, very gently in the background, certain kinds of music, it'll help. Like the three that I've read about, and there may be many more that seem to be most helpful, and are, first of all, cross-culturally, anything that has the regular drum beat. You can use African drum beat, or you can use Indian drum beat, or you can use Haitian drum beat. You know, whatever has that kind of rhythm.
It reminds us of being in the womb and hearing the heartbeat of the mother.
Second one is some of the, and it's interesting how these things emerge when you need them, but some of the new gentle jazz that's coming out. Jazz music is—they're finding, as the people in the super learning and so on are finding, literally getting what they're doing is they're finding these things get in tune with one's own natural body rhythms, and by putting that on, it begins to tune. The other is some of the particularly Baroque music of the classical period, like a lot of Vivaldi, Pachelbel's Canon D has been studied as. In fact, I did some teaching of body work and certain kinds of massage work, and I used it in some training sessions. And then the group met afterwards, and I just, for the fun of it, I'd used a lot of Pachelbel as backup music for relaxation. So people, when they're letting go of the tension in their arms and so on, I put it on, and the group fell asleep in 4 minutes.
Morphogenic fields.
Some of Bach. What, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of music that's coming up now. There's some that, to my ear, sound like railroad sounds. And if I put that on, I keep waiting for the shift that next boxcar. But other people find that really gets them in tune with themselves. So don't worry, there's no one right thing. It's to find the piece of music that fits for you in helping to get in tune with yourself. And rather than saying, well, I must be doing this wrong or whatever, yeah, okay, I'm having trouble getting in tune with my own breathing or whatever, put a piece of that kind of music, the music that works for you. And the final thing I want to say before we try this other is that there's some work by two men by the name of Roger Mills and Suarez out of Miami that have found that one way of accessing the whole brain is... if you start with the idea that to get there, you need to do something that's pleasant for you, that's quiet. In fact, in their doctoral program, the first thing that the people going through the doctoral program do is they'll say, well, what would you like to do? Well, I'd like to go take a walk. Okay, take a walk. And they'll spend 4 or 5 days taking a walk or reading or just sitting and relaxing. And one, you know, sometimes getting angry. What does this have to do with the doctoral program? And but anything that is comfortable and lets you relax. And then once you get into that space, whatever it is you're trying to deal with, whether it's a social problem or a personal problem, To raise that concern is an open-ended question. To merely say, I wonder if there's a different way I could look at this. Or I wonder what it is I'm to be learning from this experience right now. And then with the passion of the most, whoever, of Jeremiah, resist the temptation to answer your own question. You know, just raise it and leave it there as an open-ended question. Because as soon as you start to try and answer your own questions, it's like literally putting a computer card in, it's going to get the same readout, and the readout is going to be the same feelings or the same pattern. But they're finding that by, in a relaxed state, putting in an open-ended question, all of a sudden, with what they're saying now is somewhere within 48 hours that, and I used to believe this and I don't any longer, that an insight will show up. It might be driving your car or something. Oh, why didn't I think of that before? You know, that's a different way of looking at it. What I believe now isn't that it often shows up as an insight, but it more often will show up like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And that's where journaling becomes so important. You get a piece here and a piece there, but somewhere within a short period of time, you've got the pieces that let the picture form. And we're going to have to pick up the other.
We've run out of time, but we'll have to do kinesiology some other time. It's how your body shows what is true for you, like if you're allergic to something or whatever.